for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Amin Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Villandetos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Diller, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, logging begins in Oregon's Blackberry Wilderness in defiance of a court order. Four military newspapers call for Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's resignation. And Iraqis debate the significance in their daily lives of Saddam Hussein's death sentence.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,836 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 50,446 civilians have been reportedly killed by the military intervention in Iraq. A new report by The Lancet places the civilian death count at more than 650,000 dead. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 6, 2006. I'm Eduardo de Landeros Tierra with the Radio Dog Cosmo.
And I'm Jim Thompson.
The Bush administration has fought all year to log in to roadless areas in Oregon. Now it looks like logging is going ahead in the Blackberry Wilderness, even without permission from the courts. Rolf Scar of the Siskiyou Project reports that Silver Creek Logging Company has begun clear-cutting healthy green old growth. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with Scar today on what's happening and what activists can do.
Yeah, as KBOO listeners remember, the Blackberry is one of the first two timber sales to cut into roadless areas on public land, so they're precedent-setting in that way. But what we're finding on the ground now is that Blackberry, for some reason, the Forest Service has marked, and Silver Creek Logging Company of Bandon, Oregon, is cutting large, live, green, old-growth trees there in dozens and perhaps more outside of existing logging units.
What can people do, Rolf?
Well, folks can call Senator Wyden's office, and I know he's thinking about politics today, but he needs to deal with what's going on in his state as well. And you can ask Wyden to look into this and find out why the Bush administration Forest Service seems to be bending and breaking the rules every chance it gets.
And the rules, though, according to this cutting plan, they're not allowed to cut healthy green trees. I mean,
well,
am I right?
Well, they keep repeating over and over again. The Bush administration Forest Service officials keep saying that Biscuit was only about dead legacy trees. And here's an instance of, trees hundreds of years old, live green trees, perfectly healthy, outside of logging units being taken off here and there sort of opportunistically, I think with the hope that no one would notice.
Who's actually cutting?
Silver Creek Logging Company, the company that's become infamous over the last few years, cutting not only the first roadless area logging project in the nation, that's Mike's Gulch, but also Blackberry, the second one, and also the company that was involved with the fiasco last year in which the Babyfoot Lake Botanical Area was accidentally clear-cut.
An entire botanical area was accidentally clear-cut?
17 acres of the botanical area. The botanical area, thankfully, was larger than that. But this was a botanical area called Babyfoot Lake Botanical Area. It was created in 1963 because it was the world's largest concentration of the rare Brewer's spruce tree, along with other rare plants and flowers. So there's been a lot of, like I said, rule-breaking and bending down at Biscuit. And it seems like this, which is the last Biscuit timber sale, thankfully, unfortunately, is also accompanied with another breaking of the rules.
Anything else, Rolf?
Well, this is all happening with the backdrop of Greg Walden, our congressman here in Oregon, pushing a logging bill through Congress. It passed through the House earlier this year, and now he's looking to attach it to an appropriations bill in the upcoming session of Congress that deals with post-fire logging, among other things. I think this is another example of why that bill is not needed. We need more sideboards and more safety checks on this sort of logging, not less.
That was Rolf Scar of the Siskiyou Project. You can reach Senator Ron Wyden's office at 202-224-5244, and Senator Greg Walden can be reached at 202-225-6730.
A Eugene Sand and Gravel Company says it would like to sell the public about 1,200 acres of land for a park named for the company's founders, rather than see the land developed for homes. under Measure 37. The owner of a property restricted by land regulations can apply either to have the restrictions waived or be compensated for the decrease in value as a result of restrictions. In its Measure 37 claim, Wildish Land Company of Eugene says that when it bought the land decades ago, the company could have put homes on it. But later, county regulations limited the land to mining, agriculture, and logging. The asking price is based on an appraisal of the 1,200 acres that shows the company could net $31.5 million if it sold the property for residential development. Wildish officials said that for the county, they would cut that price by $5.5 million to only $26 million.
The National Weather Service in Portland has issued a flood warning for Northwest Oregon and Southwest Washington's coastal basins. The following rivers in Oregon to be affected are Nehalem River near Foss, affecting Clatsop and Tillamook counties. And heavy rain continues to fall over the North Coast Range and surrounding area this morning. It looks like it's going to continue into this evening. The warning is in effect until 11 p.m. tomorrow. The Weather Service says to expect widespread lowland flooding and numerous flooded rural roads from the Foss Gouging Station downstream to Nehalem.
And the National Weather Service in Medford has issued a high wind warning for South Central and Curry County coasts. Cities in the warning area include Coos Bay, North Bend, Reedsport, Coquille, Brookings Harbor, and Gold Beach. The high wind warning went into effect about 4 this morning and will stay in effect until 10 tomorrow. Gusts up to 60 miles an hour will develop today across the South Oregon coast. The strongest winds will develop in the afternoon and are expected from Gold Beach northward. The greatest potential for damaging winds is tonight as the front moves south into the area. The winds are expected to decrease later tomorrow.
The Oregon Department of Forestry has issued a debris flow warning for northern counties of Oregon. Officials are urging motorists to slow down and maintain extra distance between other vehicles. It is a reminder that with considerable and sustained rainfall, drivers are more vulnerable to landsliding and debris flow as well. Debris flows are dangerously rapidly moving landslides. Steep slopes and canyons and gorges and the mouths of mountain streams are the locations at greatest risk. The state of Oregon has issued the debris flow warning for Clatsop, Columbia, Tillamook, Western Washington, and Western Yamhill counties.
The Oregon Energy Facility met Friday in the Dalles to consider approval of amendments to site certificates for two wind farms in Sherman County. Klondike 3 Wind Project LLC is requesting an amendment that would make changes to the physical layout of the facility. It would allow the certificate holder to use wind turbines having a higher generating capacity than currently permitted in the site certificate. Portland General Electric is requesting an amendment to the site certificate for the Bigelow Canyon Wind Farm. It would name PGE as the certificate holder in place of Orion Sherman County Wind Farm LLC. All county meetings are open to the public.
Washington police and state lawmakers are talking about changes that could help prevent the theft of wire and other metals from recycling. One idea is to make scrap dealers operate like pawn shops. Sellers would be required to provide identification and say where they got the material. They would have to wait 30 days to be paid. State Representative Mike Armstrong of Wenatchee expects the proposal to come up during next year's legislative session.
No one's being evacuated just yet, but there is concern for a neighborhood of homes south of where a wildfire is burning in Southern California. Authorities say 50 acres of brush have burned so far in an area about an hour east of Los Angeles. The fire is near the intersection of two major highways in San Bernardino County. Meanwhile, the youngest of the five firefighters killed in the Hughes wildfire near Palm Springs is being remembered at his funeral today. Daniel Hoover Najera was just 20 when he died.
The Perseid meteor shower in August may be better known, but this year's Leonid meteor shower, expected later this month, may be more spectacular. On the evening of November 18th and into the following morning, the Earth will pass through the densest field of dust and tiny debris left by the passing of comet Swift-Tuttle. It has produced spectacular showers in the past. In 1996, for example, the Leonid shower produced as many as 40 meteors per second, or that's 144,000 per hour over over the American Southwest. Astronomers say it should be a good show for the Northwest and this year, with up to 100 meteors per hour visible.
Eugene police say a man was handling what he believed to be an unloaded gun and shot his two roommates, one fatally. 20-year-old Bradley Everett died in his Eugene apartment late Saturday, and 23-year-old Nathan Post was treated and released. 22-year-old Zachary Kaysen was interviewed by investigators and booked into Lane County Jail on unrelated warrants. Detective Tony Veach says Kaysen thought the weapon was unloaded. The bullet passed through Post's leg before hitting Everett in the abdomen.
Legacy Emmanuel Hospital's Child and Adolescent Treatment Program has been awarded a Mental Health Excellence Award. It is from the Oregon Department of Human Services for Emmanuel's program for its collaborative problem solving, which is a child and family-centered care model. It has resulted in a 76% reduction in patient seclusion and restraint since its implementation 2 years ago. Sponsored by the DHS Addictions and Mental Health Division, the Mental Health Excellence Awards recognize Oregonians who are working to improve mental health services. The CPS model begins with the premise that behaviorally challenged children are poorly understood. These children have learned that explosive or aggressive behavior is an effective means of getting attention or coercing others into granting their wishes.
Intel has donated computers to 30 sixth graders at Paul Butte School and Tumalo Community School. These two schools are part of the High Desert Education Service District, which is one of three districts in the state that will receive computers. Each of the students is receiving a personal laptop as part of a grant from Intel Corporation. The students will keep their computers through 7th and 8th grades and into high school. The sixth grade teachers at each school will also receive their own laptops. Officials say the Oregon Department of Education will also contribute $100,000 toward the program.
An Army reservist killed in Afghanistan was remembered in the Dales as a man who tried to make a difference. Staff Sergeant Robert Paul was killed by a suicide bomber in September. Before heading to the Middle East, 43-year-old Paul was a land use planner for Wasco County. Governor Kulongoski and Congressman Greg Walden told those in the audience about Paul's service to his country.
Some political speculation has shifted from the governor's race to the future of fiscal issues in Salem if Democrats take over the state legislature. Democratic leaders say their ranks will include rural and suburban members who are fiscally conservative. They also say that features of Oregon law work against the legislature's ability to make many changes. The last time a single party had both the governor's office and the legislature was 1989 through 90, when Neil Goldschmidt was governor. Under Democratic control, the legislature passed several fiscal reforms. Amid a lot of squabbling, however, it failed to pass a school funding plan that relied less heavily on local property taxes.
There is just one day left for Oregon voters to get their ballots in, and with reports of voter intimidation nationwide, particularly for immigrants, a new public service campaign is urging Oregon voters to know their rights. Oregon AFL-CIO President Tom Chamberlain has been instrumental in the campaign. KBOO's Emily Young reports.
Election day is tomorrow, and although many Oregonians have already sent in their ballots, some election observers are concerned intimidation could keep many citizens from voting. A new public service campaign by the Oregon AFL-CIO is urging Oregonians to know their voting rights and report any attempts to interfere in the voting process. President Tom Chamberlain says the controversy over immigration has many legal immigrants scared to vote.
We want to make sure that every Oregon citizen, whether they're native-born or foreign-born, exercises their right to vote.
A number of Oregon candidates have alleged that undocumented immigrants have voted illegally. But the Secretary of State's office says there are no documented cases of such voter fraud. For the KBOO News, I'm Emily Young.
On eve before election night, political parties are making a last-ditch effort to rally their supporters to the polls and convince the undecided of the same. With polls suggesting Democrats could take control of the House and possibly the Senate, if they are correct, will liberal-leaning activists have a friend in power? FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
It's been a busy few years for peace activists. Many have spent their time protesting the policies of the Bush administration. The war in Iraq, domestic wiretapping, treatment of detainees, and the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, to name a few. High-profile, month-long protests have given a platform to people like Cindy Sheehan, the military mom whose son died in Iraq. Now, with most Americans displeased with the Iraq war and the president's poll numbers resting below 40%, a Republican sweep in Tuesday's election is not likely. If the Democrats do take control of one or both of the legislative bodies, they say they will change Washington by providing oversight and investigation into the president's policies. Will this satisfy those voters who say that the war in Iraq is one of their main concerns this election? David Swanson is director of ImpeachPAC.org, a political action committee dedicated to candidates who have supported possible impeachment proceedings for President Bush.
Well, we set a very high bar for incumbents and have ended up not endorsing a single incumbent. We required that they have introduced articles of impeachment, and no one has.
Nancy Pelosi, House Democratic leader, has said impeachment of the president is off the table. ImpeachPAC has their hope in new candidates. They stand behind 24 Democrats who are running on an impeachment platform. Senate candidate Carl Sheeler of Rhode Island and Chris Owens, candidate for a New York House seat, have the best chance of winning. But David Swanson remains confident. He refers to a change in committee leadership should the Democrats win.
Once John Conyers is the chair of the Judiciary Committee next year, there will be a massive public movement for impeachment that will not be possible to ignore.
Outside the White House Monday, peace protesters set up camp. They'll remain until Wednesday to reinforce their opposition to the war. They are led by Cindy Sheehan, who says their job will not be complete if the Democrats win, but she hopes for a better chance of ending the war. Regarding Iraq, have you gotten any indication that Democrats might not work with you?
No, not at all. I think they will work with the peace movement.
Cindy Sheehan believes that if Democrats gain a majority, others will be willing to jump on board. She says a good place to start is the amendment by Jim McGovern, Democrat from Massachusetts, which calls for the removal of funds for the war. To McGovern's resolution, there's only 17 co-sponsors. I've asked dozens of members if they would support that, and many of them say no. So do you really think that even with the Democratic-controlled House or Senate, that that could get done?
It's an uphill battle. Like I said, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, it's an uphill battle to bring our troops home. And we're going to be doing the same thing that we've always been doing, if it's Republican or Democrat. But I think with the Democrats, we have a better chance.
Charlie Clay is the director of the Center for Corporate Policy and co-editor of the website Halliburton Watch. He believes the Democrats will use their power to investigate should they win.
We're pretty confident that some of the issues raised by whistleblowers and others would be fully scrutinized, and handing subpoena power over to Representative Waxman and Senator Dorgan and others is no small thing, no small outcome from the election.
But not all activists share the guarded optimism. Chris Bright is joined by Emily Isley. They're from Detroit. They were dressed in orange jumpsuits to symbolize U.S. detainees, and they protested outside the White House.
You know, what are the Democrats saying? They're saying better jobs, better health care, better education. Are they out there saying we're going to bring torture to a halt? We're going to stop the illegal spying? You know, are we going to fight for... They're running anti-choice candidates now. They're totally capitulating to the right-wing Republican agenda, you know. They're trying to out-family value the Republicans.
Yeah.
I don't have any faith in the Democrats.
Chris and Emily will vote, but they'd rather protest. They say that public discourse would do more change. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
After a series of voting problems in primaries around the country, the Election Assistance Commission is poised to approve new security measures for voting software and hardware. But reforms proposed by the commission are unlikely to go into effect until long after tomorrow's election. Congress is also reviewing separate reforms to sharpen scrutiny of voting equipment companies. The purchase last year of Oakland-based Sequoia Voting Systems by Florida-based Smartmatic has also increased demands for federal voting standards and regulation. Sequoia Voting was one of the largest voting equipment companies in the nation before its acquisition.
The Democrat, who is in charge of the effort to win control of the House of Representatives, says he's not concerned with polls suggesting that a Democratic edge is narrowing. A CNN poll finds that 58% of voters who were surveyed plan to cast their ballots for Democrats for running for Congress, while 38% plan to go with the GOP. A Pew survey and a Washington Post ABC poll find the gap narrowing to between 4 and 6 percentage points, however. Congressman Rahm Emanuel, who chairs the House Democratic effort, says it was expected that Republicans would start to recover. Republican Party Chairman Ken Mellman says in an Election Eve memo, cites new polls that he says show the Republicans with, quote, strong momentum.
Don't look for prices at the pump to get much cheaper in the coming weeks. Industry analyst Trilby Lumberg says after 4 months of declining gas prices, the cost of fuel is beginning to stabilize across the nation. Lumberg says since August 11th, when gas prices peaked at $3.03 a gallon nationwide, there has been a steady decline. The national average for self-serve regular was $2.18 on November 3rd across the country. The lowest average price in the survey was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, at $1.99 a gallon for regular. The highest average price continues to be in Honolulu at $2.77.
An American facing a death sentence in Iraq is hoping the highest court in the U.S. can help him. Mohamed Mounaf was convicted of helping kidnap three Romanian journalists. Mounaf claims his confession was coerced and his trial was flawed. He's now asking Supreme Court Justice John Roberts to keep the U.S. military from turning him over to the Iraqis. Mounaf wants to wait until U.S. courts decide whether Americans suspected of terrorism can be turned over to Iraq's government. An appeals court in Washington ordered the military to hold on to Mounaf until the Supreme Court rules.
The U.S. Supreme Court today takes up the case of an Illinois man who spent more than 8 years in prison before courts reversed his murder conviction. Andre Wallace filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against Chicago police officers after the charges were dropped 4 years ago, but lower court judges tossed it out, saying he had waited too long to file. Now the high court would decide when the clock started in Wallace's case, at the time he was charged 12 years ago, when he was cleared, or sometime in between. Some lower courts have ruled, though, that false arrest claims cannot be made until convictions are nullified.
A marijuana advocacy group ran newspaper ads Saturday mentioning allegations that President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney have behaved violently while drunk. The organization, known as Safer Colorado, which put a measure on the Colorado ballot to legalize possession of marijuana, placed an ad in a newspaper in Greeley, where Bush made an appearance on Saturday. The ad in the Greeley Tribune had a photo of Bush accompanied by a text claiming that in 1972 he tried to fight his father while drunk. The group ran the Cheney ad in the Gazette of Colorado Springs a day after he spoke to troops at the nearby Fort Carson Army Post and attended a campaign rally. The ad referred to an incident in February in which Cheney accidentally shot and wounded a friend while hunting in Texas. Referendum 44, which is on Tuesday's ballot, would allow adults to carry up to an ounce of marijuana.
Opponents are criticizing a key backer of a ballot initiative to end public affirmative action programs in Michigan after he made comments that appeared to welcome the Ku Klux Klan's support. The measure on Tuesday's ballot would ban the use of race and gender preferences in state government and university admissions. In a video posted to the website YouTube.com, Ward Connerly is shown saying, quote, "If the Ku Klux Klan thinks that equality is right, God bless them. Thank them for finally reaching the point where logic and reason are being applied instead of hate," unquote. Connerly, who is black, defended his remark, saying he accepts support for banning affirmative action wherever he finds it.
The first test of a potential new gene therapy for HIV was encouraging enough for researchers to launch a more extensive trial. The amount of virus in the subjects remained steady or decreased during the study, which involved five people with chronic HIV infection. One patient had a sustained decrease in the amount of virus, and immune cells and strength of the immune system increased in four patients during the 9-month study.
The researchers removed immune cells from the patients and introduced a virus called a lentovirus into the cells. This change prevents HIV from reproducing and has the ability to fight HIV in cells that have not been treated. Now the team has launched a phase 2 test that will involve more patients, including some whose HIV is controlled by drugs.
Christian evangelical leader Ted Haggard admitted on Sunday to buying sex and methamphetamine from a male prostitute. Up until last week, Haggard was the president of the National Association of Evangelicals, but the minister was forced to resign after the prostitute in Denver revealed that Haggard had regularly visited his apartment for the past 3 years for sex and drugs. Haggard at first denied the allegations. He wrote a letter to his congregation admitting that he had sinned. His letter was read by the Reverend Larry Stockwell from the pulpit on Sunday.
Two abortion clinics asked Kansas Supreme Court Monday to investigate Attorney General Phil Klein after Fox's Bill O'Reilly said he had information from Kansas abortion records. The clinic's attorney want the court to seize records that Klein obtained on 90 of the clinic's patients, saying he wanted to review them for evidence of possible crimes, including rape. The attorneys asked the court to appoint a special prosecutor to determine if O'Reilly's information came from those records. O'Reilly said Friday on his show, The O'Reilly Factor, that an inside source gave him information that a doctor at one of the clinics had performed late-term abortions. O'Reilly deemed it, quote, executing babies. Klein spokeswoman Shireen Jones has said the attorney general doesn't know how O'Reilly obtained the information.
A new poll suggests that half of New Jersey voters agree with the state Supreme Court's ruling that gay couples should get the same rights as heterosexual couples. But only one in four say homosexual unions should be considered marriages. The state's high court left it up to the legislature to determine just how gay couples will be given the same rights as married heterosexuals. The state's governor prefers the term civil unions. State lawmakers have said using the term marriage would make it hard to pass legislature on the issue. An official from the firm conducting the survey says the numbers indicate that people are struggling with the issue and are trying to decide what is fair. The poll was conducted for New York Star Ledger newspaper.
In Tokyo, Microsoft announced it will launch a major new program in Japan to promote the use of its products among small and medium businesses. Speaking at a conference in Tokyo, Microsoft Chief Executive Officer Steve Ballmer said the company's additional investment would be in the tens of millions of dollars. Microsoft said the new program would include the opening of 4 new Microsoft stores nationwide, bringing the total to 11 by the end of 2007. The Redmond-based company also said it would conduct a nationwide bus tour to promote its products and services. Microsoft software dominates the Japanese market, as it does with much of the rest of the world. The company also boasts key business partnerships in Japan, including those with electronics makers as well as game software makers.
Looks like the White House will be looking for a new ambassador to Iraq. A senior Bush administration official says the current ambassador will be quitting in the months ahead. Zalmay Khalilzad is expected to take a job either in the academic world or in the private sector. Exactly when he'll leave is not clear, but the official says he will likely stay through the spring. Khalilzad has been in Baghdad since April of last year. He's a Sunni Muslim who at first was criticized by Shiites for favoring Sunnis. But now the Sunnis are complaining the U.S. isn't doing enough to protect them from Shiite death squads.
And since it's 5:30, it must be time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
For Iraqis, the trial has meant a curfew that is now in its third day. But
excellent news, Americans. At last, Bush, Cheney, Romney, and company have decided they can no longer stay the course in Iraq. No, wait, I got that wrong. They have decided they can no longer say, stay the course. Apparently, Karl Rove has looked at some polls, consulted a fortune teller, and read some chicken entrails, all of which reveal to him that stay the course is not working politically as a catchphrase. Thus, the bon mot that George W. has been hurling at us for months to explain his Iraq strategy is dead. He's no longer using it, said Bush's chief PR flack, Tony Snow. Instead, the new buzzword is benchmarks. Bush, previously portrayed as an unretreating, stone-solid war leader, suddenly is being presented as having more moves and flexibility than a ballet dancer, a veritable Balanchine of modern adaptable war strategy. Now, the Bushites say they are boldly setting benchmarks of progress that the Iraqi government must achieve to continue earning the patience of George himself. Yet, the Bush language twisters were quick to explain that these benchmarks are in no way meant to be perceived as ultimatums to the hapless Iraqi leaders. So, in other words, benchmark is just another way to say stay the course, at least until the congressional elections are over. Bush, Cheney, and Rumhi are playing their same old cynical game, using rhetorical bluster and BS as a political cover for their failed and disastrous Iraq policy. If the Bushites feel the need for a benchmark about progress in Iraq, they should look at the fact that we'll soon pass 2,800 Americans killed there by their incompetence and arrogance. This is Jim Hightower saying, these craven chicken hawks are continuing to play politics with people's lives, and they won't change. We the people have to stop their stupidity by throwing the bums out and bringing our troops home.
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
Tune for Labor Radio at 6 p.m. following this newscast. At 7, it's Time Sound with Kevin Berry. More rain, lots of rain in the Willamette River Valley and Columbia Gorge this week with highs in the mid-60s. You are listening to the handcrafted grassroots KBOO Evening News for Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The purple heather, hear the west wind cry, to know that's where the referee must die.
President Bush says the sacrifices made by American troops in Iraq have been vindicated by the conviction of Saddam Hussein for his war crimes. More than 2,800 U.S. troops have died in Iraq since the war started in March 2003. At least 16 have been killed so far this month. Nevertheless, Bush told an audience in Nebraska yesterday that his decision to remove Saddam was right and that, quote, the world is better off for it. Democrats also praise the verdict but are still criticizing Bush's leadership in Iraq.
Fighting continued across Iraq Sunday despite a curfew imposed by the U.S. military and Iraqi security forces to coincide with the delivery of a verdict in the trial of Saddam Hussein. There were also celebrations at the announcement of a verdict of guilt and a sentence of death for Saddam Hussein. But for many Iraqis, the event is another prop in an increasingly flimsy production. David Enders files this report with Salam Taqib.
For Iraqis, the trial has meant a curfew that is now in its third day. But Majid al-Samra'i, a producer for Sharqiya Television, an Iraqi satellite channel, says that in many ways, the last 2 days have been indistinguishable from others.
There is no life in Baghdad. All the neighborhoods are shut down. Even when they are not enforcing a curfew, people are still not on the streets at night. Most of the neighborhoods close at 3 p.m.
Ali Salman said he was frustrated not by the ruling, but by his inability to express himself. Salman lives in Shab, a central Baghdad neighborhood which has remained largely insulated from ethnic cleansing and sectarian violence, but not tensions.
I can't express my feelings in my neighborhood because I don't know how people will react. If I'm happy, the Saddam people will not be happy. If I'm not happy, the Badar guys will not be happy. So I can't express anything.
Michael Scharf is a law professor and co-founder of the Public International Law and Policy Group. In 2004, he traveled to Iraq to provide training for judges working on the tribunal. He says that it is possible the verdict, a full written version of which should be released later in the week, would also have some resonance in the U.S.
Saddam Hussein said that he was justified in attacking the town of Dajjal because it was a hotbed of terrorists and insurgents, and they tried to assassinate him. And His lawyers pointed out that the United States has made the exact same arguments with respect to towns throughout Iraq and Afghanistan. And so when the judgment comes out, it will have to explain where that line is to be drawn. And I think we might find that the United States has tiptoed pretty close to that line or even crossed that line ourselves with respect to the black sites that the CIA has, the targeted killing policies against terrorists, the treatment of terrorists in military commissions that violate the Geneva Conventions, and other things.
There has been international debate about the tribunal's decision to permit the death penalty, which was part of Iraqi law before the invasion. Richard Reed spent nearly 2 years in Iraq. Much of it is a U.S. liaison to the tribunal. He says though many Iraqi lawyers and judges are against the death penalty, in this case, it would have been hard to imagine another outcome. Iraqi leaders such as Muqtada al-Sadr have publicly questioned why Saddam has not already been hung, and Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki said this week that he hoped Hussein would receive the death penalty.
The vast majority of the Iraqi people who were victimized by Saddam Hussein, and I don't think any American can understand what that relationship is like between a person living in a country like Iraq and their oppressor like Saddam Hussein, but those people really would not have tolerated some decision by their government to suspend the death penalty in this kind of a case.
In addition to demonstrations in support of and against the deposed dictator, Al Jazeera reported that Iraq's Ministry of Interior ordered two television stations off the air, alleging that they were inciting violence after Saddam Hussein was sentenced to death. In other areas, Iraqi army attacked pro-Saddam demonstrators. Depending on the speed of the appeal, the execution is likely to take place within a year. I'm David Enders with Salam Talib, reporting for FSRN.
Security in Iraq remains tight following the death sentence handed to its former leader, Saddam Hussein. Hussein, who was sentenced to death by hanging, had ruled Iraq for 24 years before being ousted by the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. He was found guilty of the 1982 killings of 148 Shia men and boys. This was just 1 year before he was photographed shaking hands with Donald Rumsfeld. Baghdad remains under curfew today amid fears of sectarian violence. The verdict sparked celebrations across Iraq among Shia Muslims, but triggered protests in Sunni areas. Human rights group Amnesty International described the trial as flawed.
The International Red Cross called today for the abolition of cluster bombs, saying the indiscriminate deaths they cause outweigh any military advantages. The International Committee of the Red Cross said it was stepping up its campaign against the weapons because of Israel's use of the bombs during its month-long war with Lebanon. The United States and Russia also have resisted efforts to eliminate the weapons. Cluster bomblets are packed into artillery shells or bombs dropped from aircraft. Human rights groups have estimated that Israel dropped as many as 4 million of the bomblets in Lebanon. No international treaties, including the Geneva Conventions, specifically forbid the use of the cluster bombs.
Four newspapers owned by the Military Times published a scathing editorial Saturday calling for the resignation of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. The editorial criticized Rumsfeld for an apparent lack of respect for the troops and officials in uniform and says the Defense Secretary has lost control of the situation in Iraq. The editor of the Army Times told CNN that the decision to run the editorial came after President Bush vowed to keep Rumsfeld in his position until the end of his presidency.
The issue of immigration to Europe and to the U.S. from Latin America was one of the most important issues on the agenda of an important international summit this weekend. The 16th Ibero-American Summit met this past week in Montevideo, capital of one of the smallest countries of the continent, Uruguay. Asli Poulet reports.
The summit's focus this year was immigration, and the representatives of the 22 member states, 19 from Latin America and 3 from the Iberian Peninsula, agreed upon the so-called Montevideo Commitment, which called for the betterment of the conditions for immigrants in the Americas and Europe. There are 200 million immigrants around the world. Of that number, 30 million are Latin American. Many live and work abroad with little to no access to social services in spite of their contributions to local economies. The president of Bolivia, Don Evo Morales, the first indigenous president of the continent, spoke about the problems Latinos encounter in Northern Hemisphere and condemned the unjust treatment of his peers in comparison to the treatment of those who came centuries ago from the North.
When the immigration was from north to north, there were not many problems. They were easily accepted and assimilated, becoming citizens, problem resolved. When the immigration was from north to south, it was also welcomed, even though it brought us most of the problems we encounter right now. When the immigration was from north to south, they robbed our natural resources and land from our ancestors. At that time, when people traveled from south to north, there were no walls, no deportations.
Most heads of state spoke along the same lines as Morales. Among them was the president of Chile, Dr. Michelle Bachelet.
Latin America is the most unequal region in the world, and without a doubt, it should not have been so. It is ideal for the region that the state heads in this Ibero-American summit think and see how we can join our individual forces as individual countries or as a whole so that this region, the one with the most social injustice, can be a region that is not segregated, where the discrimination does not exist, and that it can give equal opportunities to all its children.
The president of Spain, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, who participated in the summit together with King of Spain, Juan Carlos de Bourbon, said this has been the first time in the Ibero-American community there has been consensus on the issue of immigration. His government promised an aid package of $40 million to Central American countries and more visas and scholarships to Latin American students to his country. Entering to Europe as a Latino has been difficult, as President Morales comments.
Years ago, I was traveling to Spain, invited by Bilbao's local government. At the airport in Madrid, two people in uniform asked me to pay them $500 to enter the country. I was held for an hour, and they wanted to deport me, even though I presented them with an invitation I received from the Basque country in the north of Spain. I almost lost my flight to Bilbao. Finally, I got mad and told them, "For 500 years, you Spaniards colonized us. I don't have $500.
The state heads confirmed their commitment to resolve the problems of the immigrants and also demonstrated their profound preoccupation for the decision by the United States to build a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. The heads of state called for a more civilized way to resolve illegal immigration and suggested that the U.S. seriously reconsider whether to build a wall that will divide the Americas. The Mexican president, Vicente Fox, didn't comment on the construction of a wall separating his country from the United States. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Asla Pellet in Montevideo, Uruguay.
Hundreds of thousands of people flooded the streets of Oaxaca City yesterday, calling for Mexico's federal preventative police to leave the state and for the governor to resign. More than 80 people have been arrested since the militarized police force arrived in the city 8 days ago. Mexican President Vicente Fox says the presence of federal troops is to restore peace and social tranquility. Despite the heavy police presence, plainclothes gunmen continue to carry out acts of aggression against opponents of the state government, and several members of the Popular Assembly movement have disappeared.
Three explosions ripped through Mexico City early this morning. President-elect Felipe Calderón has condemned the explosions and called for more investigations. Tim Russo has the story.
At 12.08 a.m., the first of three bombs detonated in Scotiabank in Mexico City, followed by another at 12.14 a.m. in the Federal Electoral Tribunal, and a third at 12.22 a.m. in the National Headquarters for the Revolutionary Institutional Party, PRI. Each of the three explosions came after warnings made by telephone. The bombs caused material damage to its targets, yet no injuries or casualties were registered, according to Mexico's Attorney General's office, which immediately opened an investigation. No group has claimed responsibility for the bombings as of the closing of this report. The Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca has released a communique to deny any involvement in the blasts. By 9 a.m. this morning, a fourth bomb had been deactivated in a bank, and a mysterious telephone call provoked the evacuation of the Secretary of Foreign Relations office, also in Mexico City. Federal police have reported that they have yet to find any leads as to who is responsible for the triple bombing. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Tim Russo in Mexico.
Cuba's foreign minister backed away Monday from his previous prediction that Fidel Castro will return to power by early December. Felipe Perez Roque told the Associated Press that there was no guarantee that Castro would be well enough to attend the postponed celebration of his 80th birthday on December 2nd. The communist leader is recovering from intestinal surgery he underwent in July. Castro's younger brother, Raul, has been in charge of the country since July.
Peruvian police have arrested a suspect in the case of a brutal murder of a well-known Peruvian environmental activist. Pamela Cueva reports from Lima.
Police in Cajamarca have arrested a man suspect of murdering Edmundo Becerra, a leading environmental activist. Becerra was shot 17 times on November 1st after refusing to sell his lands to the Yanacocha mining project. Becerra was the president of the Front in Defense of Cajamarca, an organization opposed to the expansion of the Yanacocha gold mine, already the largest gold mine in South America. Residents of Cajamarca strongly oppose the Yanacocha's expansions as the mining work contaminates the water of the springs and rivers. Local residents say Yanacocha has been arming a group of peasants to threaten those who do not sell their lands to the company and are opposed to the mine's operations. The mine's spokesperson says that the allegations are offensive and that the company will investigate people making such claims. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Pamela Cueva with Alfredo Cuadros.
With 40% of voting stations tallied, it appears that former Sandinista rebel leader Daniel Ortega could become Nicaragua's next president. However, more concrete results are not expected until later today or tomorrow. If elected, Ortega would be the latest in a series of left-wing leaders voted into office in Latin America, joining Venezuela's Hugo Chavez, Bolivia's Evo Morales, Chile's Michelle Bachelet, and Nestor Kirchner in Argentina. Jill Raplagel reports from Managua, Nicaragua.
Sandinista sympathizers hit the streets of Managua to celebrate last night after election officials announced the party's strong lead with 7% of voting stations counted.
We are celebrating. Of course we won. We knew we won a long time ago. We are reconfirming it.
By noon on Monday, Daniel Ortega, presidential candidate for the Sandinista National Liberation Front, or FSLN, had 40% of the votes, followed by 33% for the right-wing National Liberation Alliance candidate, Eduardo Montalegre. The three remaining candidates, including Edmundo Jarquin for the Sandinista Renovation Movement, or MRS Party, trailed by a significant amount. However, despite the early celebration of Sandinista fans, only 15% of voting stations had been tallied by Monday morning, not enough to establish a winner, said election officials. Ortega needs at least 35% of votes and a 5% lead to win the elections outright. Otherwise, a runoff between the two leading candidates will be held sometime in December. If the election does go to a second round, analysts predict that Ortega would not win. After he and the Sandinista revolutionaries overthrew dictator Anastasio Somoza in 1979, Ortega led the country until 1990. But support for the Sandinista party declined throughout the 80s, fueled by rampant government corruption and mismanagement, a U.S.-backed counter-revolutionary war, and a U.S. embargo that crippled the economy. Since then, Ortega has run for president and lost three times. But yesterday at the polling station, citizens like Ninos Galitz seemed willing to give Ortega another chance.
It seems that Daniel Ortega has asked for pardon. He's asked for reconciliation. He's asked for a change, and I think he should be given the opportunity. We've had two liberal governments, and the country is always in the same misery.
Ortega's nearest challenger, Montalegre, said today that he would not concede defeat until the last vote is counted. At the same time, dissident Sandinistas lamented Ortega's potential return to power. A number of former Sandinista leaders have defected to the MRS party in recent years, including feminist writer and California resident Gioconda Belli. She said Ortega and the FSLN have betrayed the ideals of the 1979 revolution.
They have had representation in the National Assembly, and they passed the CAFTA. They recently passed the penalization of therapeutic abortion, which is unheard of for a party in the left. And that is so far from everything we have fought for in Nicaragua. And so it pains me to think that people, like the people who listen to Pacifica, are going to think that it's a great thing that Daniel Ortega wins this election. I think it's not a great thing. But I think we have begun a new movement, and I think we have as a mission to create the new left in Nicaragua and to really fight for what we think is the real way to conduct politics in our country.
The MRS party had 7.5% of votes as of midday Monday. Jill Replogle, FSRN, Managua.
The World Trade Organization is expected to make Vietnam its 150th member tomorrow. Vietnam has become one of Asia's fastest-growing economies. Its membership will give it greater access to import markets and make it more competitive to investors. In return, it will be required to drop its high tariffs on foreign imports and eliminate subsidies for state-owned companies.
China and Africa's two-day summit in Beijing has ended with news of a $1.9 billion trade and investment deal. On Saturday, China's President Hu Jintao pledged to double assistance to Africa by 2009. China has become the biggest source of aid for Africa. Critical voices say they worry that Chinese unconditional aid to Africa could encourage undemocratic governments.
The Forum on China-Africa Cooperation opens today in Beijing, China, and it gathers ministers and some 45 heads of African states to discuss economic and cultural relationships. China needs Africa's mineral resources, particularly oil, and Africa seeks to boost its economic development. From Ndiega, SEC has more.
More than 40 African heads of states gathered in Beijing for a weekend summit with China on trade and investment. China seeks to strengthen cultural and economic ties with Africa. As its economy booms, China's drive to buy African oil and other commodities has led to a big increase in two-way trade worth $42 billion in 2005. According to Senegalese economist Adam Agay, who's just published a book entitled China, Africa, the Dragon and the Ostrich, China is a good example for Africa's development.
China has succeeded in solving all difficulties and challenges she had in the past, and they are very similar to the challenges Africa faces today. Like Africa, China has experienced a long internal war and colonial humiliation. Like Africa, China has known bad political management, so China will offer the adequate response. Since 1978, China has solved her problems by herself. She didn't wait for the World Bank or any other foreign sponsor to address her problems. That's an example Africa can follow.
Africa is also a growing market for Chinese goods. Many African countries have seen Chinatowns thriving in their capitals and in many other big cities. But critics say Beijing is stifling African manufacturing. For many Senegalese, Chinese products are affordable and fit their purchasing power. Demagen Bay, a Senegalese woman, says Chinese business is necessary, though she fears for Senegalese economy.
The Chinese come like saviors because with a little sum of money, you can wear acceptable clothing. You can buy clothes and shoes at a very low price. They rent shops that they pay and hire young people and pay them too. Therefore, for the average Senegalese, the Chinese business is profitable. But Chinese business is a threat to the Senegalese economy.
Some 2,500 separate business deals could be discussed during the first China-Africa summit, many expected to revolve around Chinese need for African mineral resources, particularly oil. To gain African leaders' esteem, China has invested billions of dollars in aid, cheap loans, and helping to upgrade key infrastructure across Africa. But for Senegalese President Abdoulaye Wade, Africa cannot continue to live on aid.
We can't develop a continent on aid endlessly. It doesn't make sense. It's never happened, and it never will happen. Africa must generate resources. Try to find other resources to develop. As someone said years back, the end goal of the aid is to end the aid. We must be assisted to go without assistance one day. We must go into globalization with our own means and fight to find a place of our own.
The three-day summit celebrates 50 years of diplomatic relations between China and Africa, as economic relations with the West have yet to take Africa out of poverty and underdevelopment. It remains to be seen what impact South-South relations will have. For FSIN in Senegal, I'm Jaga Sek.
United Nations climate talks have opened in Nairobi with a focus on Africa. A new UN report released yesterday says Africa's vulnerability to climate change is worse than previously thought. It predicts global warming could lead to a 5% drop in food production by 2080, while rising seas could engulf large areas.
The Israeli assault on the town of Beit Hanun in the northern Gaza Strip continues for the sixth straight day. Saeed Bakhnoura has the latest.
Two teenagers were killed today in Beit Hanun, bringing the death toll to 52 since the Israeli invasion began last Wednesday. Today's deaths came after an Israeli missile strike on a school bus. A Palestinian woman blew herself up near a group of Israeli soldiers in Beit Hanun today, injuring at least one of them. Also today, hundreds of medical personnel and dozens of ambulances lined the streets of Beit Hanun in commemoration of two paramedics killed on Saturday in Israeli attack. Despite the high number of civilian casualties, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert pledged today to continue the siege on Beit Hanun until the Palestinian resistance stops firing shells into Israel. For Afas Aran from IMEMC.org, this is Saad Banoura in Beit Sahur, Palestine.
Uganda's Lord's Resistance Army rebel leader Joseph Kony has asked to meet with United Nations humanitarian chief Jan Egeland. The Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs is traveling to southern Sudan's capital Juba next week. He will rally support for the Juba peace process aimed at ending Uganda's 20-year insurgency. A Lord's Resistance Army spokesperson said the rebels want Egeland to put pressure on the International Criminal Court to drop war crimes against Kony and his deputy.
An Egyptian wanted in connection with the 2004 Madrid train bombings was convicted today on international terrorism charges in Italy and sentenced to 10 years in prison. The court in Milan convicted Osman Syed Ahmed and Yahi Rage of subversive association aimed at international terrorism, a charge introduced after the 9/11 attacks. Prosecutor Maurizio Romanelli had demanded a 14-year sentence for Ahmed, arguing that he had ties to a terror cell whose reach extended throughout Europe and even to Iraq. Ahmed, one of the chief suspects in the Madrid rail bombings, is to go on trial in Spain early next year, along with 28 other suspects in the Madrid bombings. Spanish authorities have never identified him as one of the masterminds, although they do say he played a role and have charged him with conspiracy to commit murder. And that's the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 6, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203. Or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. That goes for news tips as well. Call us with your news tips at 503-231-8032, extension 203. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, on translator K264 AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM, on translator K220 HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Mike Monkfold. Our wire editor is Brendan Wright. Tonight's audio editor is Lisa Loving, and special thanks to reporter Emily Young. Our engineer is Matt Bingley, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Jim Thompson.
And I'm Eduardo de Landeros Tierra with Cosmito the Radio Dog. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Abe Proctor and Joe Hurist host Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. Your calls are always welcome. At 9 on Between the Covers, Ed Goldberg speaks with Jan Burke, author of Kidnapped, a mystery thriller of corruption in a cult-like family. And then at 9:30, it's Black Book Talk with a focus on black authors. Then at 10, hear two former Israeli soldiers talk about their experiences serving the Israeli occupation in the West Bank. They are members of Breaking the Silence, an organization dedicated to revealing the day-to-day character of the military occupation of Palestinian land and communities. And then at 10:30, it's Stage and Studio on, and the time topics are artists, repertory, theater. And then at 11, it's Democracy Now. That's all right here on Cable, your nonprofit, handcrafted, volunteer-powered, listener-sponsored radio station. And volunteer with our humble broadcast by calling us at 503-231-8032, extension 203. Gracias, paz y amor.
Want to be more involved with your community radio station, KBOO? The Governance Committee will meet Wednesday, November 8th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. Subsequent meetings will be the first Tuesday of the month. Committee work is open for participation by all KBOO members. That's the Governance Committee meeting this Wednesday, November 8th from 7 to 8:30 p.m.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344. And also by AFSCME Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.ws.
Welcome to Labor Radio, the only program of its kind in Oregon and Southwest Washington. I'm your host, Bill Zimmerman, Teamsters Local 206. It seems we've grown accustomed to U.S. jobs being shipped overseas or new U.S. companies springing up everywhere except here at home. And I know we've all heard stories of company headquarters being moved offshore to avoid taxes, or corporations scanning the globe, not just for cheapest labor, but for countries without labor standards or environmental concerns. In the late 70s and 80s, it seemed everything was made in Japan, then Mexico, and when you walk into many businesses today, it seems that almost everything is produced in China. I thought it might be interesting to take a look at the labor standards in China and see what's going on behind the Great Wall. Later on tonight's program, we'll be talking to Verlene Jones from Seattle on counting every ballot and Dan Denver from PCAST on the Peru Free Trade Agreement. But first on Labor Radio is Jeff Barley, professor of Asian Studies from Pacific State University. Jeffrey, welcome to Labor Radio.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for the invitation.
Oh, you're more than welcome. And Jeffrey, I know you wear more than just professor of Asian Studies. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I will. At Pacific University, I'm the Matsushita Chair of East Asian Studies, and the corporation is better known in this country as Panasonic, I suppose. And they funded a position at Pacific some years ago, which I'm pleased to occupy. I've lived in China, Chinese culture for six some years. I've had two Fulbrights. I teach at Wenzhou Medical College on the mainland of China for 6 weeks each year for the past 4 or 5 years. I speak Chinese pretty well and have followed China as a career for a very long time.
Well, Jeffrey, usually I do the show is on U.S. corporations or U.S. labor law or NLRB decisions, and I'm very uncomfortable in moving out of that area into global society and talking about jobs and conditions offshore. So I guess I'm going to depend on you quite a bit tonight to help me out here because I'm a little nervous trying to get into this part. But I've always wondered, because when I think of jobs overseas, I think I always lump them together in one group, just sweatshops. you know, whether it's China, Bangladesh, Mexico, Peru, wherever it's at. I always just come up with that one term. And maybe I'm hoping tonight that you can put a little bit of color onto that word, sweatshops.
Well, I'll certainly try to do so. And you're not alone, of course, being uncomfortable in this area. It's a very, very complicated area. After all, China has a more or less continuous history of some 2,000 years. And to try to just jump in and understand any particular issue is difficult. And invariably, all of us try to understand something new through what we already know. And when the object that you're trying to understand is as different as China, then you can run into a lot of problems. I think what I would like to do before I get to the sweatshop is sort of discuss issues, differences between the two cultures that I think are really important. I think it very important that labor understand from a broader perspective the issues that are represented by terms like sweatshop. So let's begin with some critical differences between the two cultures.
So you're saying there's a difference between workers and our government in this country versus workers and our government in their country?
Yes, I am. The underlying purposes of both cultures with regard to definitions of the individual, proper forms of organization, etc., are very different. I would argue, for example, that in the United States, we think of ourselves first as individuals, and then we think of ourselves as organized into interest groups. And the classical interest group in American culture, of course, labor and capital, employers and employees. And that's very easy for all of us who have been in the union movement to understand. The role of government, since at least the New Deal, has been to be a kind of a super referee, to referee between these interest groups, to provide a legal structure in which the interest groups are balanced off against each other in the national interest, and that means ultimately in the interests of the individual. Now, labor has been, of course, the classical spokesman for employees. And the government then should provide, so far as we're concerned, to labor the right to organize, certain legal protections, NLRB elections, those kinds of things. But the large corporations, I think, in the United States, really over a rather long period, but certainly accelerating in the last 20 years, have increasingly seized control of government through a variety of means. And the result is that they've destroyed that imbalance, the erosion of the American labor membership is, I think you'd agree, very symptomatic of that. So very large corporations are increasingly ignoring the interests of us either as individuals or other interest groups. And the consequence is that they are exporting jobs and production to reduce costs. And this they think of as internalizing profits, of course, to try to pull as much profit out of the production chain as they can and hang on to it. They're externalizing costs by reducing the taxes they pay, increasingly by outright evasion, by raiding pension funds, and by reducing worker security and welfare.
So then in this country, what you're saying is it's almost like a 1-2 punch. Number one, where we're less being unionized and corporations are moving away from that idea of a labor force, and then number two, we're moving our jobs overseas so that we don't even have to deal with it over here in this
country. Yes, and in part because the government no longer has provided for us the referee function that we all assumed it would.
Right.
Rather, one interest group has become dominant, and whether you want to call that employers or corporations or capital, that's the interest group that is dominant, and we have a considerable imbalance. Now, the Chinese assumptions are entirely different. Because of the fact that their underlying value system is what we would call Confucianism, and that may mean something to some of your readers or listeners. Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, or other Confucian states. So when I talk about China, I don't really see the issue of communism, non-communism as a critical issue here so much as I do much more enduring Confucian assumptions that have been around for a very long time, almost 2,000 years, and are also reflected in communist ideology as such. They don't see, that is, the Chinese or the Koreans or the Japanese, don't see individuals as organized into interest groups. That's not the main issue for them. But as all members of a harmonious society, if that society is properly organized, interest groups themselves are injurious to the common good. So, in order to reflect on what I just said, say that we try to referee between interest groups in our culture. The Chinese assumption is that we should all be part of one big interest group, and that interest group is the culture. They don't see individuals then as the problem or the group to be looked at. The task of government then is not to be a referee, but to be on the one hand a good example, and two, to look after the common culture, to make sure that the system functions in part because the same system of values is replicated generation after generation after generation. So an agreement on the common good is what the Chinese want to have, or these other Asian systems as well. So the task of government then is quite different in that society. And in that society, all individuals should first see family as important. And then from family, they scale up. So by the time you get to the government, you're really talking about one big family. Now, that also may imply one big father or a lot of elder brothers. But nonetheless, that's the situation. Now, historically, to the Chinese, big threats have been local independent regimes based on particular geographic or economic areas. And in these regimes, local elites take over political and economic and military functions and become what they call independent kingdoms. Now, there's a sense in which that is happening, has happened in China today. Now, that's hard for us maybe to grasp because we continually emphasize the totalitarian, highly centralized nature of the Communist Party. But in fact, the government of China is relatively weak compared to many other governments.
So if I'm hearing what you're saying correctly, even if a Chinese worker wanted to join a union to better himself, it would almost be viewed as against their culture because it's not for the common good of the whole society.
That's certainly a logical deduction. I would say more, both the Chinese and the Japanese, Korean sense would be that the union and the relationship with the corporation should be much closer than is the case in our country. Now, we went through a period when unions were extremely paternalistic, and I think we used to use the term yellow dog, right? Well, the Chinese union, the purpose of the union is to help the corporation maintain harmony in the interests of both the worker and the union itself. So certainly you could imagine labor disputes in the Chinese case, but they would be a failure on the part of the larger culture of both the corporation and the union, and in a sense of the government itself, if such were to occur. So you're probably more familiar with Japanese strike actions, in which you don't actually strike. You wear an armband that says, I protest, I'm on strike,
right.
And you keep working.
And in Japan, it's almost like, so what you're saying is that an individual would have like an individual contract with an employer rather than the whole bargaining unit, what we think of in this country, having a contract with the employer.
That is correct, although the new law, the draft law that sort of kicked off our joint interest in this is called a draft labor contract, which was released in April of this year in Beijing. It really does two things that are important. One, it promises to enforce existing laws, which have not been adequately enforced in the past. And second, it does impose contractual obligations, fresh contractual obligations, particularly on foreign firms. Mm. And the Chinese have come to that new law, I would argue, because of problems with what I'm calling harmony. That is, harmony is recently endangered in China, and they're looking for a solution. One problem that we're familiar with, I think, is that local party groups, that is, Communist Party groups, and industries are clearly exploiting Chinese labor. There's no question about that.
Right.
Now, half of the trade imbalance with China, half of China's export product is produced by firms that are fully or largely funded by foreign corporations. So what I'm saying is then when we look at Chinese export surpluses, half of it that we're looking at is really foreign It is foreign direct investment in Chinese corporations. Now, the local sweatshops that you mentioned are more often than not subcontractors to those international corporations. So the consequence is that we're looking at a production chain, particularly in the local areas, in which the local party figures, corrupt subcontractors running what we would call sweatshops, are ultimately producing in the interest of foreign firms, which are funded by direct foreign investment in China.
So what I'm hearing you say is there was peace and harmony until U.S. corporations or European Union corporations came in and demanded, because I go back to Walmart, and I did a couple of shows on Walmart, and I heard the average wage in China was 38 cents an hour unless you worked for a company that produced something for Walmart, and it was only 13 cents an hour. So they wanted to drive down costs. So is this where, and I guess I'll call it labor unrest, okay, right, instead of harmony. Is this where the labor unrest came from? Was corporations coming in and kind of taking over the workforce and making demands?
Well, in part. I wouldn't overemphasize the harmony before that, because China has gone through a great deal of strain in the last 20-25 years. They've gone since 1980 from a population in which 70% of their people live below the poverty line to a period today of where less than 5% of the people live below the poverty line, their poverty line. And that's just a tremendous fast pace of change. And obviously there's been a lot of stress in that period. But you're correct that a lot of the labor unrest is focused at large production firms. Now, the government has chosen to focus that labor anxiety, if you will, on, by using this new labor law, on specifically foreign firms. And I think that represents a large transformation that is occurring in Chinese society. Now, there are many, many groups of laborers who are exploited, migrant workers, part-time workers, particularly workers in rural areas. Now, the other larger problem that the Chinese are noticing is that foreign direct investment itself is becoming an unnecessary liability, because the side effect of having half of your export product in firms controlled by foreigners is that a lot of the profit goes away, right? Because right, the foreigners are going to repatriate that profit, in our case, to Caribbean nations.
See, kind of like Walmart here in Oregon.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the Chinese government, you have to kind of extrapolate from what they're doing, but I think they're beginning to say, well, you know, we've got quite a bit of money built up here. In fact, they now have $1 trillion U.S. dollars stashed away, so there certainly is a considerable war chest there for anything they wish to undertake. They have also learned that they can manage the technology and the management and take it over for themselves. They've been over the last 20, 25 years on a rather steep learning curve, learning to be modern. Now they're able to do it. So the other problem they're facing is inequality. They've got inequality between the urban areas and the rural areas, between the coastal areas and the inland areas, and it has reached the point where in China it is only slightly less than in the United States. And from the Chinese government's perspective, this is a crisis, which says something about both the Chinese society and our society, I'm afraid. So what they propose to do then is to enforce existing labor laws, driving up wages and job security as well in the large foreign firms. And that will raise all the wages, of course.
So is the fear, where's the balance between, we went there for cheap labor.
Right.
And we went there because there is no labor standards.
That's correct.
And we went there because there's no environmental enforcement.
Or a few, anyway. Yes.
Exactly. And so with this new draft labor law, is the fear that corporations will now move on? Because I can remember the CEO of General Electric said his idea of the perfect factory was built on a barge. And when I docked it here and the workers started to grumble and wanted two or three more cents per hour, we'll just untie it and move it down somewhere else and find workers that will work for two or three cents an hour less.
The American Chamber of Commerce in Beijing is complaining. They responded with, I think, an 80-page position paper, all the reasons why this was wrong. U.S.-China Business Council, once tied into Henry Kissinger, they're all opposed, as are so the European business unions.
Well, what about the workers?
Well, unusually, in the Chinese case, they sent out requests for draft for discussions on this draft that the government put out and got more than 19,000 responses, primarily from professional union members and workers. So they're being very, very cautious moving forward. I think they really see the draft, the labor law, as an absolute necessity. Now, the question is, what is the point at which China's lower production costs, and it's not only lower production costs, it's also highly educated, highly disciplined labor. One of the things that attract foreigners is that Chinese are capable of really high-end production processes, mm-hmm. more so than many other countries, because of discipline and, again, because of the Confucian environment, which one studies very hard to accomplish whatever one wishes. So someplace between the attractiveness of the China market and then the foreign corporation fear of rising costs, there's a balance point. And I think what we'll be seeing over the next few years is a kind of tug of war between the corporations and the Chinese government to find out where that balance point is. So they will drive up wages in order to increase the wealth of laboring people. They will strengthen unions to a degree in the Chinese case, because that's going to have the impact of providing worker security. And, of course, if we raise the wages in foreign firms, it will also cascade to an extent across other firms in China. So this is a deliberate attempt to deal with these issues of harmony and to end the unrest at a time when they're confident that they needn't be too worried about foreign firms. Some of foreign firms can go away. It'll be fine. Chinese will just take them over.
I guess I find the fact that the Chinese government invited comment on this new draft labor law from workers, I find that very interesting. I generally would think of China as a closed society and not very democratic. If you could speak to that. And then number two, would the union structure look the same in China as it does in the United States?
Well, let me take the second one first. Definitely not. It will not, because every organization of any significant influence in China is going to be party influenced and monitored, whether party controlled or not. They just are so afraid of what they call Luan disorder. And it's easy to imagine that in a country of their size with that population and with their history that their concern about disorder is extreme. And that, of course, is the reason that they're acting now, is because they are experiencing disorder instead of harmony. And so they want to do something about it. So the labor movement there will always be kind of centralized. Now, that doesn't mean it's not a labor movement. It doesn't mean it's not a bona fide labor movement that can be a public voice that can represent workers' interests. It means it's not the American labor movement.
Right.
But I think that
it's progress for China.
It's very definitely progress for China. And one reason we feel that China has been just so incredibly successful, the reforms of the last 20-some years, Bill, is because they've been really deliberate, been very slow by world standards. A lot of people have wanted to see faster progress here or there. But what the Chinese wanted was unqualified success and to not run the risk of problems if they could possibly avoid them.
So earlier I brought up the term sweatshops, and I mean, to me, I think of that as, 1,000 workers crammed into a small room, heat, working 14-hour days, making 12 cents. Let's not even talk about overtime, holiday pay, vacation pay, or health and welfare, any of that. Is that the average Chinese worker, or has it risen above that?
Oh, it's certainly not the average Chinese worker, but it exists, and it is a fair description of some places that I've seen, not only in China, but in Hong Kong under the British as well. It's the reason why foreign firms are often attracted to those areas. They're the very, very large pools of labor without many other options. Those situations can exist in China, however, only where there is a local agreement. This is why I'm talking about independent kingdoms, if you will, where there's a local agreement between corrupt government officials, and that's often also corrupt party officials because they overlap to a certain degree, and then corrupt entrepreneurs. And very likely those entrepreneurs are part of the production chain in the export industry because that's where all the profit is. And the consequence then is that this labor law is going to cascade right on down the line.
it's very hard for the Chinese at the national level to get away with the things they can get away with at the local level, because they have very draconian methods, of course, of punishment for corruption at the national level.
So how do you see this playing out in the next 3, 5 years, 10 years? Do you ever see China, and I'm not even saying that the United States labor movement is particularly the right labor movement, right, but from what you're describing, I'm seeing this as a company union.
Well, it's more like a government union, and the assumption of the Chinese is certainly that that union will be centrally directed. Now, on the other hand, there are advantages to a centrally directed union. There are obviously many disadvantages, because if we're in a local area where the union is dominated again by corrupt groups, then it's going to lack power. But on the other hand, the government can put a great deal of pressure and force between a centralized union. We used to have organizations that talked about one great industrial union,
right,
and
right,
and we wanted right. it, right? Now, here's
I
a country.
I don't see the problem either, by the way.
Here's a country that has it. Now, potentially, I there's no doubt about the courage of Chinese individuals. I mean, you know, from Tiananmen forward, right, we've right, certainly right. seen people come out and risk a great deal. So my guess would be that the union is going to change things, and in part because the government wants it to. Again, mm-hmm. I come back to the point that the government wants to increase worker security and wants to increase salaries and wages, and just to have a contract. The things they, you know, the irony behind all of this is, if you think back on many of the justifications for jobs being exported, for American investment abroad, what's it been? It's always been, we're going to create democracy. We're going to raise the economic level of these countries, and they will then become democratic, and the world will be a much safer place. Now we have one of these countries wanting to organize, unionize, raise wages, and who do we have opposed to it? The American corporations. All of a sudden, democracy is not as important as the bottom line, right? So it makes pretty clear what the bottom line always was in these particular cases.
That's just so interesting. It's reality, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Very much so.
Yeah. And, well, Jeffrey, I got to tell you, we just about spent a half hour here, and so far it hasn't even hurt. I was very worried about doing this because, again, I'm getting into an area that I don't know, and you made this very easy for me, and I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you. I'm going to duck out of here, but let me recommend two books to your
absolutely.
Listeners. One is by a scholar named Ross, R-O-S-S. His first name is Andrew. It's called Fast Boat to China, Corporate Flight and the Consequences of Free Trade, Lessons from Shanghai. It's a really exciting recent book that has a great deal to say about labor, capital, modern China. He'll present a China that is easy to understand, and he writes very well. So it's Andrew Ross, and I'm happy to say that Powell's has one in stock for $16.95, and after that, you're on your own at Amazon. And the second book is by a journalist named Fishman, F-I-S-H-M-A-N, Ted, China Inc. And Powell's has one of those, too. And then after that, Amazon.com. But I would say those two together would be a real education in the issues that we've been talking about tonight, Bill. And thank you again for the invitation.
Well, I'm glad, because I want to start doing this a little bit more and get a little bit deeper into this. Not that there's not enough, you know, problems in the United States, but I guess we need to expand. The corporations are expanding. I guess I need to expand too. I need to come into 2006, I guess, is what I have to do. So, Jeffrey, anything to close? If anybody had any questions, is there a way? Do you have a website or anything like that?
They can use my email, okay. Barlowj, B-A-R-L-O-W-J, at PacificU, P-A-C-I-F-I-C-U, .edu.
Okay. And you can contact Jeffrey with any questions. And, Jeffrey, you know you're coming back, don't you?
Oh, I'd be happy to.
Well, you're
so.
Coming back. Again, this didn't even hurt, and I really appreciate you taking your time. I know it's terrible weather out there, and I know the traffic is atrocious, and I appreciate you coming in and doing this, and be safe on your way home.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, folks, I guess we'll move a little closer to home in our global expansion of Labor Radio, and we'll move down to Peru, I guess. And in the studio is Dan Denver. Dan, welcome to Labor Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, I'm glad to have you, Dan. Now, I know you're a member of PCAST, if you want to explain a little bit what PCAST is.
It's the Portland Central America Solidarity Committee, and we were founded in 1979 to defend the revolution in Nicaragua. But over the last 26 years, while we've continued doing a lot of solidarity work in Latin America, currently we're involved with supporting the social movements in Venezuela and El Salvador in particular, and trying to work against U.S. intervention in those countries, both military and economic. We've also seen that the way the U.S. and U.S. corporations exert control and dominance over the region has changed over the last 26 years, while as in the 1980s, it was sort of, you know, economic interests in the region were backed up by pretty severe military force. It's moved into now with you know, into the free trade era of NAFTA and CAFTA through U.S. corporate control through purely, not completely economic, but this, it's a new means of economic dominance. So we've refocused our efforts on working in Portland and throughout the region, especially building partnerships within the labor movement and with local unions to organize against these free trade deals that are not only horrible for our partners in the campesino, you know, farmer and in labor movements in Latin America, but are an absolute disaster for working people in Oregon. So we've much more started to focus on that.
You know, one thing I learned from Jeffrey, and I know you were sitting here listening to that conversation, and he made the statement that the Chinese workers, a very educated workforce. And, you know, they build whatever they build, and they're very good at it, and they get modern at it. And some of these free trade agreements in Central America, I mean, we're just talking about, like, sugar and beets and different things where it's not so much the educated workforce to go into. This is more of a physical labor-type agreement.
Most definitely, and having a huge impact on agriculture. And the Oregon Fair Trade Coalition, which is a coalition that PCASC and a variety of other organizations and unions in Oregon are a part of, just came out with a very interesting study showing that Oregon has lost at least 68,000 jobs to free trade. And a lot of those are in just those industries, like Amalgamated Sugar and Nisa Oregon.
That's a Teamster unit, by the way.
Yeah.
It used to be.
Well, a lot of these, not by coincidence, were good union jobs,
right,
including
right.
The Freightliner in Portland, which was 770 jobs. The Amalgamated Sugar was 475 in a town of, I don't know, 2,000 or something. It's absolutely devastating.
So that's a major impact.
Oh, yeah.
And this is in eastern Oregon?
Uh-huh. And in Woodburn, AgriFrozen, a food processing plant.
Right.
That's 453 jobs right there.
Right.
And the thing is, these jobs, you know, just as the previous guest was saying, in China, the rhetoric is that it's going to raise the working and living standards of you know, these poor workers in Latin America and Asia. But the fact is, it's not just bringing our jobs over to their countries. To get a willing workforce down there, the way these trade deals work is that they restructure the economy to ruin the way that things went on before. For example, in Mexico, you know, to get all the workers for the sweatshops on the border, the maquiladoras, what they did is that they, using the agricultural provisions of NAFTA, wiped out Mexico's agricultural economy. So 3 million small farms are closed because of NAFTA. That's a lot of, and if you think about how many workers and how many families depend on one farm, I mean, that's just an incredible amount of people. So these free trade agreements ruin the, you know, pre-free trade economies of the country, forcing workers into the new sweatshop free trade economy.
If you just joined us, it's a little after 6:30. You're listening to Labor Radio. I'm your host, Bill Zimmerman, and we're talking to Dan Denver from PCAST in Portland, and we're talking about the Peru Free Trade Agreement. Dan, you know, I remember back when we first heard about free trade agreement and NAFTA and all of that. And I was really, when I went and did research on this, I came across almost word for word the same rhetoric that I heard back then, how great it was going to be for American workers, how it was going to increase this and how it was going to do that, and also how it was going to raise the standard of living in Mexico. And, you know, I'm seeing that same thing in the Peru Free Trade Agreement, only 10 years after NAFTA, we don't see a raised standard of living in Mexico. Is there any hope for this?
I mean, it was ridiculous enough the first time around when they were making these promises about raising wage standards, promoting democracy and human rights and all of that stuff. Ridiculous enough the first time around. Now that we actually have that NAFTA actually has a track record, yeah. You know, since it was implemented in 1994, it's completely preposterous that they can claim over and over again that the NAFTA and CAFTA model works for working people or the environment or democracy anywhere in the world. Some notable things about Portland's track record is that, I mean, the NAFTA's track record is, as I mentioned, the 68,000 Oregon jobs lost to free trade. In Mexico, in destroying these small farms and in destroying small Mexican manufacturing, it has been the main force behind Mexican immigration to the United States. People don't hire a coyote to cross an extremely dangerous desert where thousands of people die every year just trying to, you know, make it to the U.S. They don't do that for fun. They do that because they're forced to, and they do that, ironically, you know, for the right wing in the U.S., they do it because it's our economic policies and our free trade agreements that we're pushing on Latin America that are forcing people to migrate to the U.S.
It's almost like it's a plan. I was talking to Jeffrey about the 1-2 punch, and here we are, you know, they're telling us how great it is and how it's going to raise the standard, and yet there's this mass move northward, okay? And you know, I don't have a problem with the worker. I think you know, you said it earlier, it destroyed culture, the regular culture that was in a small city in Mexico. And not only does it come in and now everything is upside down and different, and I'm sure a lot of these farmers are losing their farm and they have a family to feed and they come up here. So to bring along another free trade agreement and then talk about building a wall, I guess I get a little confused in all of this.
No, I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous to blame the current immigration phenomenon on immigrants and not on the U.S. corporations and the U.S. free trade policies that are destroying Latin American economies and driving people, literally driving people from their homes to the United States. And then the hypocrisy of the same right wing that has pushed all of these free trade agreements to then say, oh, no, we have to build a fence on the border.
Right.
You know, we have to keep our country strong. You know, national security, this is a country of laws.
Well, I actually think they want them to come north because they like that lower wage. And I know they don't like my wage or my benefits package, okay? And they would they would much rather have, a worker stand on it. And, I mean, back in the early days in American labor movement, you stood outside on the other side of the fence and the boss would come out and say, I'll take you, you, and you, and the rest of you just sit there and wait. I might need you later on in the day. And I'm sure that's what American corporations, and it's not even just corporations, I think it's small employers too, that enjoy this influx of not just cheap labor, because I think cheap labor is a part of it, but I think these workers are also unwilling to file any type of complaint, any type of documentation on anything. Mm-hmm. It's just, hey, I'm going to use you for 6 hours, give you a couple of bucks, and I'll see you maybe next time.
Yeah, it's completely false, the claim that on the part of U.S. corporations that they want to keep immigrant labor out of the country. They want immigrant labor here, but they want it here without any rights, without the right to organize, without the right to join unions, without the right to speak up and fight for a just wage. So I think what the labor movement has by and large realized that there's a two-pronged solution to fixing the current situation with immigration. One, putting a stop to these free trade agreements that are, again, driving immigration in the first place. And two, organizing immigrants currently in this country. Because immigrants are here to stay. And as long as they're living in the shadows and are undocumented, it's going to be a two-tier labor system.
Right, but that's not easy, organizing immigrants in this country.
No.
No, but, so, I mean, that's not, to me, that's not really an answer.
you know, maybe in 10 years it may be an answer. But today it's not really an answer because, you know, a lot of these workers are just, they just want to make some money and send it home. They want to stay under the radar as much as possible.
But actually, if you look at the studies of the surveys they've done of who in the United States is most willing to join a union, immigrants are overwhelmingly more likely than a native-born worker. Hmm. And native-born workers are already 50, 60-something percent more likely to say that likely to say they'd join a union if they could. Immigrant workers are overwhelmingly more likely to say they would. So there's actually a lot of potential you know, militants for the labor movement in the undocumented immigrant population.
Well, if there's anybody out there that wants to join a union, give me a call. I can take care of that right now. It's not easy, but it's well worth it in the end. So where are we in this the Peru Free Trade Agreement? Has it come up for a vote? Is it coming up for a vote? Where are we at in this?
So what it looks like is that Bush and the Republican leadership in Congress, as well as, you know, a significant number of pro-free trade Democrats are planning on sneaking the Peru Free Trade Agreement in during the lame duck session after tomorrow's election. So we could see it on Wednesday. And so
that's soon?
Yeah. And it's really shameful. I mean, pretty much anything you see in the lame duck session is stuff that they didn't want.
Right.
Because so many people would not want to vote for an agreement that would be so horrible for their constituents right before the elections. So they're sneaking it in after the elections.
So if this passes, and I mean, what do our Oregon senators, I mean, what do our Oregon congressions say about the Peru agreement? I mean, I can imagine right off the bat some are for and I would think some are against.
Well, everyone except Peter DeFazio, who probably none of the listeners are in his district, every single other representative and senator from Oregon has refused to take a stand on the Peru Free Trade Agreement. Two Democrats of particular concern to people who live in this part of Portland, where KBOO is located, are Senator Ron Wyden and Representative Earl Blumenauer. Earl Blumenauer came out and voted against the Oman Free Trade Agreement. He voted against CAFTA, but he still insists that he's somehow, philosophically committed to free trade, so always refuses to take a stand until the last moment. So right now it's a very crucial time to contact Earl's office, or you know how to contact Earl himself. You know, give him a call and let him know that this is word for word the same NAFTA-CAFTA model all over again for Peru.
Right, and isn't, if this passes, doesn't it just open a door for other small countries in Central America to be forced, I would say, to join on this?
Oh yeah, there are a few different free trade agreements in line. The next main one in line after the Peru Free Trade Agreement is a free trade agreement with Colombia, and just a few points on labor in Peru and why this would be a disaster not only for working people in Oregon but for working people in Peru. Peru has 2.3 million child laborers. It has an incredible problem with child labor right now. And Peruvian labor laws allow a lot of boss interference in organizing drives and allows companies often to unilaterally change contracts. Just a little quote from the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions annual report on Peru. Employers, particularly multinational companies, appear to be able to flout trade union rights with impunity, perpetually ignoring rulings by the labor by the labor ministry and recommendations by that ministry to recognize and negotiate with their workers' unions. So Peru has really been demonstrated itself to be a country that has absolutely no regard for labor rights.
That's why we want a free trade agreement with them.
Exactly. And yeah. I think the only country that has shown itself to be on par with Peru is actually the United States, because the Peruvian president, bowing to Peruvian union demands, asked the U.S. Trade Representative to include International Labor Organization, ILO, standards in the Peruvian Free Trade Agreement. And this is really amazing and is what has really infuriated people about the Peru Free Trade Agreement. The U.S. Trade Representative refused to include ILO standards. in this agreement. And this is after years of these people saying that, oh, we can't include labor standards in free trade agreements because those poor countries can't afford to have labor standards like we do. And here in the situation with the Peru Free Trade Agreement, you actually have, you know, this third world country demanding that we include ILO standards in the free trade agreement, and the U.S. government refusing, the Bush administration refusing.
Well, that's where they want us to go here. I mean, I think it's just a matter of, I think we can look at Peru and maybe see the United States in 15 or 20 years. I think it's just, they said they wanted a level playing field. I think they're leveling the playing field. Only I don't think we all thought it was going to be way down at the bottom somewhere. I thought we were going to raise standards up somewhere, and that's not what's happening with these schemes. I call
exactly,
them schemes.
Exactly. It is a scheme.
Yeah. And I know we've spent a lot of time on labor provisions, but I'm sure there's environmental concerns that go along with this also.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is one of the most environmentally critical parts of the world. In the Peruvian, in the tropical Andes, you know, which is part of the Amazon rainforest, it's the most biologically diverse region in the entire world. And just like with labor rights, the Peruvian government has a horrible track record of protecting its natural resources from invasive mining, oil, pipelines, all sorts of logging of old growth rainforests. I mean, a lot of really, really bad environmental practices.
Policy.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And this would basically just be giving a thumbs up to Peru and saying, great way to take care of your environment, and make it even easier for U.S. corporations to get in there and destroy Peru's environment.
So I'm a little confused here because, you know, I'm just a worker and I come down here and do this as a volunteer and talk to you who does this because he cares about it. And in 15 or 20 minutes, you know, we talk about this particular subject and it's pretty easy to understand. It does not work. Mm-hmm. So why do Oregon senators and congressmen want to sit there and say, well, I'm open to this, when it's so obvious that there's extreme problems with this?
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons behind this. One is because we, as working people in Oregon, haven't held these politicians who vote for free trade deals consistently, like Senator Wyden, accountable for their votes. We just give them a little slap on the wrist over and over. So I think we have to hold ourselves responsible to some degree and say we need to take these free trade agreements a lot more seriously and hold politicians accountable when they vote against workers' rights in Oregon and in Latin America. Two, it's because, you know, regardless of what we say, a lot of these politicians are not really listening or just paying lip service to organized labor and are a lot more interested in what big business and big donors are saying.
And I think a lot of us really don't pay attention like we should. And it's easy to – I think some people don't connect free trade agreements to job loss or to immigration and that type of thing. So,
the question about connecting job loss, I mean, that's a big thing that the right's trying to do right now is redirect everyone's attention to immigration, saying they're stealing your jobs, because that's something, you know, concrete. You know, these are flesh and blood human beings. You can put them in a commercial, in a political commercial, but free trade agreements and the way the global economy is working right now, which is a global attack by corporations against working people everywhere, you know, that can be seem a lot more abstract. So it is with a lot of education. Go out in your unions and talk about this. You know, in your workplace on
that's
the shop floor.
One of the jobs of PCAST, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Well, Dan, I appreciate you coming in. Time just zips by when you're having fun, I guess. And I can't believe I made it through almost 45 minutes of global corporations and free trade agreements and not stumbled all over the place, because this is not my area of expertise. Although I do want to spend some time here more and more in upcoming shows, so I want to invite you back.
Great, thanks.
Because I want to do more of this so that I get a better understanding of what's going on, and maybe I can help with that education process. And I definitely agree with holding politicians accountable. I think that's what's missing in our society today, is holding people accountable. accountable for their actions, and politicians are the one. And I can see the connection between free trade and job loss and immigration problems. I'm not so sure they can't.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right.
Dan, thank you, and I appreciate you being here with us.
Thanks very much.
And on the phone tonight, we have Verlene Jones from Seattle. She is the president of A. Phillips Randolph. Verlene, welcome to Labor Radio.
Oh, good evening. Thank you for having me on.
Well, Verlene, I got to tell you, I know that you're probably doing about 600 things with tomorrow's vote, and I really appreciate you taking time and coming on and talking to us about this. You're involved in a project called Counting Every Ballot. You want to tell us a little bit about how that got started and kind of where you're at now?
Well, we know most of your listeners, all of the disenfranchisement that has been happening to voters' votes since the year 2000. And more we've had to have a movement going to ensure that every vote is being counted. And here we are in the year 2006, and each year seems to get worse than the year before. It's kind of frightening, but I think America's stepping up and they're starting to look at something. So it may look as though it's getting larger. I think we're just now starting to look at abuses that have been there that we just didn't notice.
Right. And the Help America Vote Act, has it really helped Americans to vote, or has it been a hindrance in seeing some of these discrepancies in counts?
I think right now there's so much confusion. Depending on what state you are and the situation that you're in, just understanding the ballots and how to vote and what your rights are. Here in Washington State, they're changing yearly. We have voters going into the polls for the first time where identification is mandatory. Hmm. And a lot of them do not know that. And so how do they feel when they walk in, a freedom to vote and not have their vote feel like it's being attacked, unimpeded? These are the concerns that we have, is that people will be intimidated by it and walk away.
Right. Is this what you're doing? Is this part of, is this just Washington doing this, or is this a broader?
It's a national campaign.
Okay.
Across the country, especially in targeted states. We're trying to make sure that the votes are counted.
Okay. And how are you doing that? Are there any attorneys or lawyers involved?
We have a team of lawyers. There is a national bank of lawyers on the day of the election that all of our local command center lawyers can call into to get more information about voter abuses if they need that assistance. But they are on a local level, have also been trained on the laws within the states that they're working in. We have put out voter bill of rights in most of the targeted states so that all of the voters know what their rights are going to the polls, whether they are doing voting at the polls or they're doing absentee ballots. We've been trying to give people as much education as possible.
So you have trained poll monitors?
Yes.
And are they, because I mean, I know when I vote, I go to a school, and there's some really sweet elderly people there who really want to help. But sometimes I wonder if they're really catching everything that's happening. Is that still what's going on today?
Well, our poll watchers will come in a lot more trained on what to look for. And as they're standing in there in those bright lime green colored vests that say, "Ask me about your voter rights," it lets the people in the polls know why they are there. Their job is to listen to conversations, making sure that people are not turned away from the polls for any reason. Here in Washington State, you should always be able to cast a provisional ballot.
Now, isn't Washington State in transition between mail-in and going to a poll and vote?
Yes, it is. It's in transition, but, you know, we don't want this to lull people to sleep. We are finding right now, as a matter of fact, I got a phone call right before this interview from our command center saying that this weekend, as they were doing phone banking, the majority of the responses they were getting from people was that they didn't get their absentee ballots. There were name errors on their absentee ballots. They had sent back no signature match, letters saying that there was no signature match.
So this goes along with the problem of removing likely voters from voting registers?
Exactly. So we can't be lulled to sleep just because it's an absentee ballot. We're right now going to spend the day tomorrow calling back a lot of these people this weekend that had concerns about their ballot, letting them know that they need to go to the polls, please cast those provisional ballots, and then taking as much information as we can to follow up on why all of a sudden their ballots, they're having problems with their ballots.
So do we anticipate any problems in Washington or where is the hot spot in the country today?
I can't say where the hot spot is. I think if you look from state to state and how the elections are coming out and what the results of the power that can happen in our government for Democratic versus Republican, we have a lot of states right now that are hot.
Right, right.
And if a Democrat gets an office, it's a big thing. It's going to make a difference.
Right, especially to working people. I mean, that's kind of my focus here.
And I'll say this because our project is nonpartisan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We are not telling people who to vote for.
Right.
We're just trying to make sure that your vote is counted.
Absolutely, and that's all we can ask for, isn't it?
Yeah. Right, but that, I think the important part about that is we bring out more of America's vote. There is a concern that these informed, educated new voters are not going to be in support of where our present administration is.
Mm. Let's hope so.
And so in that, we have to make sure that whatever votes they cast, they're counted.
Was Washington targeted because of problems or because of the close election in the last governor's race?
Close election is one of the big things, you know. I think they're still finding ballots from that election.
Right, right.
And that's an important thing. Absentee ballots. How do you end up with a box of ballots that were in the corner in the back and you find it 2 years later, you know? How do we set up a system to where we can track every vote? Even if it's an absentee ballot, I should be able to track my vote to make sure it was counted.
So are we anticipating any problems in Washington? I know in Oregon it's a mail-in, so there's actually a trail, and it seems to be a very simple system. I don't know why we don't all go to that type of system.
I think even with those systems, they need to be monitored.
Right, because the optical scanner can be.
Yeah, the calls that we'll be making tomorrow are to people who are in that system.
Right, right.
And are having problems.
Well, phone banking is very important, and I know there's some people listening tonight that have been phone banking for the past 30 days, it seems like, and I just want to say hi to them and hope they're all doing fine at that phone bank, and I'll be there tomorrow night.
Yeah.
But, you know, I heard on the news this morning there were robocalls going into certain states where the Republican Party was pretending it was the Democratic Party and coming out with a position that people would be against. And making those phone calls to people's home like 25 or 30 times on Sunday so that likely voters would be so upset with with the Democratic Party making all these phone calls in the positions that they're taking that they're figuring that it's going to turn down the vote in those areas. Have you heard anything about that? Or
I haven't heard a lot, but I would say this. I whenever I hear conversations like that, I say we're not giving credit to our very educated voters.
Okay.
And voters are making decisions not on these commercials and all of this, these phone calls and all of these tactics. They are actually educating themselves on the issues, and they are voting because they're passionate about what's happening in our country today.
Absolutely. Do you anticipate any problems in Washington this cycle, or just are you there monitoring?
We're here monitoring. We want to be sure that we see and are able to capture problems that may come ahead as we move to full mail-in ballots. But we want to make sure that we have a system that is ensuring that everybody's vote is counting in here. As I have a young girl that talked to me in church yesterday, she's been voting since she's 18 years old. She's in her early 30s. All of a sudden, she gets an absentee ballot where her first name is spelled wrong.
Hmm.
And she has asked for a duplicate ballot, and the ballot hasn't come.
Hmm.
And she comes to me and says, so what should I do? I'm concerned. Right now I can say to her, go to the polls and vote a provisional ballot.
Right,
I want to make sure when we go to strictly mail-in ballots that she is able to have an option how she can ensure she gets her vote cast.
Right, so would that ballot not count because it's the wrong name? Is that
right? It'll be a no-name match.
Well, what about the provision ballot? I mean, that's not a secure way either, is it?
At least with that, she can track it. She can go in and challenge it.
Okay, okay.
And in the provisional ballot, she can say, my name was spelt wrong. Here's what my name is. You can go in there and try to work to clean up some of the errors that are going on.
Right, but should voting have to be that complicated? I mean, shouldn't
no.
you? Should, thank
Gosh.
You. I mean, you should
know,
just walk in and vote and go home until you contributed to this.
I still say this is the year 2006, and we don't have a nationwide program
thank you.
Of voting that happens the same way in every single state across the country, in every city, every county, and it is one that is protecting the voters' rights.
Right, with some type of trail, absolutely.
Why is this so difficult?
Well, I don't think it is, but I don't think it's the goal of too many politicians.
And that's why I'm concerned.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we have to continue to monitor any system that's up. Any system that's up needs to have public scrutiny.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, Verlene Jones from Seattle, I wanted to get you in here and I want to talk to you a little bit because I want people to know that, you know, I don't think we hear too much about this, what your job on mainstream media. And all too often I hear people complaining that no one's doing anything. And I'm just so glad that somebody is doing something. And I just wanted to have you on the show so I could say thank you for what you're doing. I
appreciate
it.
Thank you so much. And I just wanted to say that everyone that is working for our program are volunteers. And we're expecting to have a huge turnout tomorrow, and that's because people do care.
Okay. Well, Verlene Jones from Seattle on making every vote count or counting every ballot, I really do appreciate your work, and thank you, and keep it up. And if you have any, if there's any problems that really come up and you're concerned in that, I'd appreciate it if you give me a call back, and I'll get you on another show, and we'll talk about how you found that and how
Absolutely.
You dealt with it. Because I want to educate people on how this is really happening and maybe keep their eyes open so that we can get a fair election in this country. And I think that's all we're asking for is a fair election.
Absolutely. Okay. Thank you so much.
Well, Verlene, I appreciate it, and thank you, and good night.
All right. Good night. Mm-hmm.
And with that, we'll come to an end to another Labor Radio, and I want to thank everybody for tuning in tonight and listening. And I know in Oregon you've already voted or you need to get that ballot in as soon as possible. I think in Washington you can actually go to a poll and go ahead and vote. And I think that goes for Teamsters, too. I think you still have time to get that ballot in the mail and change the union like we want to change this country. And with that, I'll say good night. Thank you.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day. And also by Ironworkers, Shopmen's Local 516, and the Pacific Northwest Ironworkers District Council, proudly fighting to preserve living wage jobs and resisting their outsourcing. Information at 503-257-4743.